I feel like we are incredibly conditioned these days to think that the most graphic, visceral image of destruction always makes for the most powerful
Right.
protests.
Absolutely. It is a very human assumption to make.
Right. Like, we just have this collective assumption that if we show the world the bloodiest, most agonizing photograph of a shattered building or a wounded civilian in Gaza, it's going to finally be the thing that wakes everybody up.
Yeah, we tend to believe that visibility just automatically translates into empathy and, by extension, action.
Exactly. We expect the sheer horror of it to act as a global alarm clock, just jolting us out of our daily routines.
Because the thought process is that if a tragedy is right in front of our eyes, on our screens, on the evening news, we just can't possibly look away. So we'll be forced to care.
But I've been thinking about this a lot. What if the exact opposite is actually true? What if this relentless hypervisibility, I mean, the endless daily stream of graphic photojournalism, is actually the very thing causing our apathy?
It's a really heavy thought, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
The shock value just wears off over time.
Yeah, think about it. When absolute tragedy is packaged for quick daily consumption on our feeds, we just sort of digest it along with our morning coffee and move on. It's meant to shock us, but eventually it just anesthetizes us.
We just become totally numb to it.
We do. And so that brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive. Because today we are looking at a piece of art that flat out refuses to be easily consumed.
It really does. It
No.
fights back against that exact spectator apathy.
It's an audio analysis of a painting called Homes and Faces I. It's by the artist Jairo Duque, and it's part of his larger book project, Trastio. And we're going to explore how this specific artwork uses cold aesthetics, artificial intelligence, and extreme abstraction to basically fight that numbness.
And before we get into the actual mechanics of the artwork itself, we really need to set the parameters for how we're discussing this today.
Yeah, that's crucial.
Because the context here is intensely political. To understand the art, we have to look at the artist's personal framing of it.
Right, his own words.
Exactly. Duke describes his work as contemporary militant surrealism. He explicitly created this piece as a protest against what he terms the genocide by Israeli Zionism against Palestinians.
Wow, okay, that is a very direct framing.
It is. In his view, this is a reality that is deliberately hidden by global media. And he argues it's actively obscured by massive spectacles of distraction. Specifically, he points to the machinery of the 2026 World Cup as a major tool of that global distraction.
And just a quick pause for you listening, because obviously we are dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict here, and we know things are intensely polarized. Our goal today on the deep dive isn't to take a political stance or, debate who is right on the geopolitical stage.
Right, we are just looking objectively at the source material.
Exactly. We're putting on our art critic hats to look purely at the mechanics of this protest. We want to examine how an artist takes his own intense, deeply held political outcry and actually translates it into paint. And honestly, whether those specific artistic choices achieve the impact he's aiming for.
Which brings us to the central tension of Duke's work. It forces us to ask a really difficult question. When you take an unfolding, visceral human tragedy and you abstract it, do you actually preserve our human empathy?
Or do you run the risk of intellectualizing the pain so much that people just stop feeling anything at all?
Yes, that is the exact paradox we're looking at.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to figure out why this painting feels so utterly devoid of traditional explosive emotion, we have to start at its genesis. And it starts in a way that feels, I don't know, completely contradictory to a human protest.
Oh, it really does.
Yeah.
Because we aren't starting with a sketchbook and a charcoal pencil in a cozy studio.
Right. We are starting with code.
Exactly. Before a single drop of paint ever touched a canvas in his California studio, the reference image for this painting was actually generated using a generative artificial intelligence diffusion model.
Which is just wild for a physical painting.
It is.
Yeah.
And we really need to look at the mechanics of how that works, because it entirely changes the DNA of the artwork. An AI diffusion model doesn't just create an image out of thin air,
Yeah.
it actually operates through systematic destruction.
Systematic destruction. Okay, how so?
It takes real existing data, like real images, and it begins to inject what is called stochastic noise.
Wait, stochastic noise? You are going to have to break that down for me because that sounds incredibly dense.
I know, it sounds like a physics lecture.
Yeah.
But imagine taking a crisp, perfectly clear photograph of a house.
Okay, got it.
Now, imagine randomly turning one tiny pixel of that photo white, then another one black, then another white. You do this thousands of times a second over and over until the original picture is completely obliterated.
Oh, wow. So it would basically just look like the static blizzard on an old broken television set.
Exactly. That systematic obliteration, that static, is stochastic noise. The AI pulverizes the original image into absolute unrecognizable white noise, and then, using these incredibly cold, unfeeling mathematical probabilities, the algorithm reverses the process to hallucinate an entirely new synthetic pattern out of the static.
I have to admit, I am super skeptical of this approach.
How come?
Well, if you're an artist trying to protest the destruction of human lives and human homes, and your very first step is to use a machine that mathematically obliterates real images to hallucinate a synthetic one, I mean, that feels highly problematic to me.
It definitely feels cold.
Right. Isn't this like trying to write a heartfelt, desperate letter of condolence using a sterile corporate legal template? You risk losing the entire soul of the message before you even pick up a pen. If you start with a machine, doesn't the human element of the protest just get diluted right out of the gate?
What's fascinating here is that the artist isn't ignoring that contradiction at all. He's actively weaponizing it.
Weaponizing the machine.
Yes. It's a very deliberate, dark irony. Think about how modern warfare is actually conducted today. It's rarely hand-to-hand anymore. It's increasingly mediated by screens, by algorithms, by targeting software.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
The military-industrial complex calculates bombardments using the exact same cold algorithmic logic that the AI uses to place a blue pixel next to an orange one. It's all just data and probability to a machine.
Wow.
So the artist is taking that obliterating, dehumanizing digital process of modern war and making it the literal foundation of the art.
Okay, so it is a subversion. The algorithm is essentially playing the role of the aggressor in the artistic process. The AI represents this totalitarian statistical environment of the conflict. The machine is the starting point because the machine is what calculates the trajectory of the bombs in real life.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head.
But I am still stuck on how you go from a sterile computer screen to a physical painting, because digital code doesn't just naturally translate to a canvas.
And that transition is where the piece becomes truly vulnerable. The digital design is completely aseptic and perfect as long as it stays inside the computer.
Right, untouched by reality.
But the moment Duke takes that hallucinated image and tries to bring it to life in his studio in Whittier, California, it becomes subject to chaos. He transitions from a flawless digital format to traditional watercolor.
And I want to make sure we don't get bogged down in, you know, the technical specs or like the exact paperweight or manufacturer data sheets here, because what is really interesting to me is the behavioral clash between the materials.
Oh, the friction is incredible.
Yeah. He takes this highly calculated synthetic AI image and forces it to submit to the absolute most uncontrollable physical medium in the art world, which is water.
And that friction is the core of the physical painting process. Because water does not obey mathematical commands.
Definitely not.
It invades boundaries, it pools, it evaporates, it warps its environment. And Duke pairs this unpredictable water with heavily granulating pigments. Specifically, he uses Daniel Smith watercolors, which are pretty famous in the art world, for their unique chemical behavior.
Right, because they don't just act like a smooth dye, right?
Exactly. When these specific pigments are mixed with water and applied to the paper, they don't just dye the surface smoothly like an ink would.
So what exactly happens on a microscopic level?
Well, as the water begins to evaporate, the heavy particles of the pigment, physically separate from the fluid, they literally drop out of the suspension.
Oh, like sediment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because they are heavy, they fall into the microscopic crevices and textures of the paper. So they settle on the surface super unevenly.
So the pigment falls into the cracks almost like physical debris.
Exactly like debris.
That sounds like a brilliant metaphor for the actual bombings. I mean, you have a machine deciding the pristine, calculated target, and then the physical world just crumbles and settles unevenly underneath it.
You are hitting on the exact tension of his studio work. You have this digital mathematical blueprint that is being subjected to physical collapse right there on his desk.
That is wild to picture.
The friction happening in that California studio is the physical struggle of a human being attempting to manually reconstruct what a cold machine has projected while the water is actively dissolving and breaking down the attempt. It is a human trying to hold on to a structure that physics is actively pulling apart.
So we have this digital design forced into physical rubble, but what does that actually look like for the viewer? Because when you look at the final composition of Holmes and Face's eye, it is undeniably difficult to process.
It is very jarring.
Yeah, you don't see distinct houses and you don't see distinct human beings. Mm. The individuals and the architecture are geometrically faceted into this massive abstract sea of blues and oranges.
Everything is merged.
Right. The edges between what is a brick and what is a human cheekbone are completely erased. It is just one continuous blended texture of destruction.
And to understand why he strips away those recognizable boundaries, the source material offers a really powerful analogy regarding tectonic faults.
Oh, like earthquakes.
Yes. When you have a massive tectonic shift, a major earthquake, it is this colossal subterranean tension that finally snaps. And when that fault line shifts, the foundation, the earth, and the house built on top of it shatter simultaneously.
They break together.
Exactly. They break along the exact same line of fracture in the exact same millisecond. They cannot be separated into two distinct events. So the artist is arguing that in Gaza, under heavy bombardment, the physical destruction of the shelter is completely indistinguishable from the destruction of human identity.
Wow. So you are saying the violence is so absolute that the person and the building become one singular piece of rubble.
That is the reality he's portraying.
That makes painting a crying, intact human face standing in front of a ruined house feel almost like a Hollywood lie.
It would be a theatrical, melodramatic lie applied to the canvas. Because the annihilation leaves no individuality behind to mourn the building. The explosives fuse the bricks and the bodies together in reality, so Duke fuses them together on the canvas.
It's just total erasure.
Yes. The loss of individual faces in the painting exposes the ultimate horrifying reality of the violence, which is the total erasure of the individual.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because if we are talking about art as a tool for protest, we have a long established history of how that is supposed to look.
Oh, definitely. We have clear expectations.
Think about Picasso's Guernica. I mean, that is arguably the most famous anti-war painting in human history. And it was also created in direct, immediate response to the aerial bombardment of civilians in the 1930s.
A classic example.
And Guernica is fragmented, sure. It is cubist and abstract. But it is incredibly visceral. You look at it and you see the mother tilting her head back, screaming in pure agony with a dead child in her arms. There is this almost audible, visible tearing of the soul in that painting.
It gives you a very clear emotional focal point.
Right. It provides catharsis for the viewer. But in Duke's painting, you have these flat, geometrically locked, expressionless faces. So if his stated goal is to shake the public awake, to break through the apathy and the distraction of something like the 2026 World Cup, doesn't presenting a cold, emotionless face just create more of the exact attachment he is trying to fight?
It's a highly counterintuitive approach, yeah. I'll give you that. But we have to look at the psychology of how we consume media today versus when Picasso painted Guernica.
That's fair. The context has shifted.
Huge shift. In the 1930s, an image of war was rare and it was deeply shocking. Today, visceral imagery, you know, the crying mother on the news, the blood on the street, it offers what we can call fast food empathy.
Fast food empathy. I really like that phrase. But how does that actually work in our brains?
It relies on a very short-circuited dopamine cycle because it is cheap, it is quick, and it leaves your system almost immediately.
Like scrolling on your phone?
Exactly. Imagine you're scrolling and you see a graphic, heartbreaking image of suffering. Your brain registers the horror. You feel a genuine pang of sadness, maybe even shed a tear, or you share the post to your own feed.
Right, you do your little part.
And the moment you take that tiny action, your brain closes the emotional loop. It gives you a little chemical reward because you participated in the moral outrage. You've processed the sadness, you feel somewhat absolved of your guilt, and your brain allows you to just disconnect.
And then you mindlessly scroll down to a video of a cat, and the tragedy is completely forgotten.
Poof, gone.
The emotion just becomes another piece of consumable, disposable content.
This raises an important question, though. How do you stop a viewer from closing that loop?
By denying them the catharsis.
Exactly. Duke's cold aesthetics purposefully deny you that quick catharsis. When you look at Holmes and Face's eye, you are naturally searching for the crying face so you can feel sad, feel good about feeling sad, and move on.
But it's not there.
But the painting refuses to give it to you. And by refusing to give you the relief of tears, the painting leaves the psychological wound open. It forces you into a state of suspended, deeply uncomfortable engagement.
You can't just consume it and forget it?
No, you have to actively work to decode the geometry, to look at the rubble of the pigment, and you have to sit with the coldness of it all. It outlasts the fleeting performative activism of social media because it refuses to let you off the hook.
It essentially traps you in the discomfort. It demands active cognitive effort from the viewer, which violently halts that mindless inertia of just scrolling past tragedy.
It forces a level of sustained consciousness that our digital screens have largely robbed us of.
Okay, but a psychological trap, an open wound, that only works if someone actually steps in it.
That's true.
And this brings us to a massive operational dilemma for this piece of art. Where is this discomfort actually being experienced? Because the physical location, the context of the room it hangs in, changes the meaning of everything.
The gallery placement is the final crucial piece of the puzzle here.
Exactly. Because this piece was exhibited in April at the Artbox C. Thompson Gallery in Zug, Switzerland.
Zug, Switzerland.
Right. We are talking about the absolute beating heart of European wealth, banking, and neutrality. It is thousands and thousands of miles away from the real dust, the real screams, and the real conflict in the Middle East.
It's worlds away.
So what does this all mean? When you take a message that is encrypted, born from a military-esque AI algorithm, painted in highly abstract watercolor with zero explicit emotion, and you hang it in a pristine, quiet, climate-controlled Swiss gallery, doesn't the high-end art ecosystem just swallow the protest whole?
That's a huge risk.
What stops a wealthy collector from walking in, admiring the exquisite blue and orange color palette, noting the fascinating granulation of the pigment, and completely, utterly ignoring the political outcry? Doesn't the beauty of the abstraction dilute the original message into nothingness?
What's fascinating here is, if we connect this to the bigger picture of how the high-end art market functions and how art survives across centuries, we see why this is a calculated, albeit incredibly dangerous, necessity.
A necessity. Okay, how?
Is there a massive risk that the aesthetic beauty might bury the political protest? Absolutely, it happens all the time in the art world. But consider the alternative.
Each is.
The alternative is global silence. We have already established that if Duke made a literal, easily digestible propaganda poster, it might trend on social media for a day.
Yeah, and then it would be rapidly consumed, digested, and permanently discarded by the 24-hour news cycle. The media machine would just eat it.
It would become yesterday's news, buried under tomorrow's headlines. But by making the artwork complex, abstract, and formally beautiful, he is essentially infiltrating the establishment.
Infiltrating, I like that.
He creates what we can call a capsule of memory. Think about the mechanics of a gallery in Zug. Mm. These institutions are built for preservation. They have archives, they have vaults. They treat these objects as financial and cultural investments.
Right, they're literally designed to make things last forever.
The abstraction, the coldness, the exquisite execution, those elements act as a protective shell. That shell allows the artwork to be accepted and hung in places of extreme power. It smuggles the trauma of the marginalized into the halls of the elite.
Wow.
It ensures that this moment of history, this specific outcry against annihilation, will be physically preserved and archived long after the news cameras leave Gaza and the world's attention shifts to the next global distraction.
So the abstraction is almost like a Trojan horse.
Exactly like a Trojan horse.
It looks like high art. It behaves like high art. So the establishment takes it in, protects it, and ensures it. But encoded deep inside of its geometry is the absolute destruction of a people.
It is a quiet, uncomfortable infiltration of the spaces that normally prefer to remain completely neutral.
It is an incredible journey when you step back and look at the full life cycle of this one piece of art. Holmes and Faces Eye starts as this cold, mathematically unfeeling calculation within an AI algorithm, perfectly mimicking the sterile detachment of modern warfare and bombardment.
From Mushim.
Yeah. And then it is violently dragged into the physical world, forced into the chaotic, uncontrollable rubble of watercolor pigments reacting with water in a studio. It blurs the lines between human flesh and shattered architecture to deny us the easy tears of fast food empathy.
That's quite a transformation.
And finally, it travels across the world to quietly infiltrate a pristine Swiss gallery, acting as a Trojan horse for memory. It proves its power not by shouting at us with graphic horror, but by demanding our active effort. It halts our mindless inertia. It forces us to stop, to look closer, and to confront the heavy discomfort of what is missing.
And that is the challenge it poses directly to you, the listener. It asks you to examine the mechanics of your own media consumption.
Yeah, we all need to do that.
When global tragedy strikes, Do you seek out the graphic, visceral images that give you a quick, satisfying burst of fast food empathy, allowing you to close the loop and quickly move on? Or are you willing to sit with the cold, enduring discomfort of something that refuses to give you closure, something that refuses to let you look away?
It is a heavy question, and honestly, it requires a lot of self-reflection. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to mull over. We talked extensively about how abstracting this trauma into high-end art might be the only viable way to build a capsule of memory that survives the crushing apathy of the modern news cycle. But if the only way to truly protect the memory of marginalized victims is to strip away their visible tears, encode their suffering into abstract geometry, and hang it in an elite, heavily guarded gallery for the wealthy, does the art world ultimately save their memory, or does it just build a very beautiful tomb for it? Until next time, keep diving deep.